The following interview was recorded for CFRO The Pulse, Vancouver Co-op Radio's daily news show. The Pulse airs Monday to Friday at 7 a.m. on 100.5 FM and streaming live at coopradio.org.
On today's show, we hear about how the COVID-19 pandemic and its response have affected sex workers in the downtown east side and throughout our city. We'll talk to Wish Drop-In Center Society's Executive Director, Mebrat Bayane. Well, thanks a lot for taking the time to talk to us about your new project. Sounds like you're pretty excited about it.
We're very excited about it. This is something that's been in the works or part of people's dreams that predate me and since I got to Wish as well. So we're really excited to finally be on the verge of opening the doors.
All right. So tell us about what is so unique about this particular shelter and kind of how long it's been in the works.
So this is going to be Canada's first ever 24/7 shelter for sex workers. So that in and of itself is really quite significant. And it's one where it's starting from a place of acceptance that sex work is in fact work, a judgment-free place. And because we're situated in Vancouver's downtown east side, really just an important missing piece in terms of the trajectory to safer housing for women, and in this case for women who trade sex.
Tell me a little bit about how it differs from, say, a low-barrier women's shelter like we'd see at the Vivian, for instance, or somewhere else where many women would stay who are in the sex work.
Yeah. So, yes, and a lot of women love the Viv and stay at the Viv, and we're close partners of that space. So, and that one is not a shelter. That's actually supportive housing. So in this case, this would be the first of its kind that's run by a sex work support organization and where it is exclusively for street-based sex workers. So, you know, in the ecosystem of all of the different services in the downtown east side and all the different drop-ins or shelters, it's already a challenge to find spaces that are safe for women, and I would add gender diverse folks. But adding another layer of also being explicitly safe and welcoming of street-based sex workers is unique. The gap that we'll be able to fill, so for example, at any given time in Wish's pre-existing drop-in, there have always been women who are not sex workers nor have ever been sex workers that will access the drop-in. But because it's one of the only overnight spaces available to women on a drop-in basis, of course women are going to come and use the drop-in, even if they're not sex workers, and the staff will sort of do their best to redirect, but if it's in the middle of the night, there may not be any place to redirect to. So the significance of this being only for sex workers means that, well, first of all, there's a lot of changes in the programming that we've introduced to fit the schedules of sex workers, of when uninterrupted sleep time is preferred. This has been designed, built, based on quite a heavy amount of consultation that we did with sex workers that already access Wish and those that don't access Wish. And then finally, it means we will have more opportunity to let somebody who maybe isn't a sex worker be able to refer them to another place that's open and really make sure that this space can be as tailored to sex workers as possible.
Tell me a little bit about kind of what the interest has been in this recently in terms of the women that you work with. Like, what are they saying about this, the importance of this?
This is a game changer. This is life-saving, long time in the making. It's been that kind of overwhelming support and excitement that this is opening.
And there will be like staff on site as you already have at your drop-in, but round the clock residential support as well.
It'll be staff that are on the floor, exactly. And then, so that's of course 24 hours, but it's situated right next door to the drop-in and shares the same back lot, which has now since COVID been animated to be 24/7 of outdoor safe respite site. For women and gender diverse folks who trade sex. So the shelter is going to live within that structure of a 24/7 washroom trailer outside that the City of Vancouver has funded, We have marquee-style tents out back so that we can have more people in the space with while still being able to maintain distancing. And then there's also peer witnessing out back as well.
What's that?
Peer witnessing is, first off, it's driven and run by peers who are employed through our WISH Supportive Employment Program. But a peer witnessing program is one where anybody who's using substances, in order to ensure that they're not using alone, somebody is close by witnessing them using, just in case they overdose or there's a risk of overdose. So the staff are trained with harm reduction supplies and with overdose reversal training kits.
That kind of leads me into my next question, which is about COVID-19 and the kind of damage that the response has had, particularly when it comes to the overdose crisis. I'm wondering what particular effects the pandemic has had on people in sex work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. It really was and still continues to be quite a profound impact on the community. What sex workers, especially those who are doing sex work on the street, which has the least amount of choice and the highest amount of danger, was a sudden and complete loss of income, and one that wasn't necessarily going to be replaced by any of the income supports that have come online, like CERB and so on, where a lot of street-based workers, even if they were eligible, many of whom were not, but even if they were eligible, really quite apprehensive about putting themselves on the radar of the federal government as having earned income through sex work and not sure what is the ramifications going to be further down the road, since it's still technically a criminalized activity. We also saw, similar to other women-serving organizations, just an increase in violence against women. And whenever that happens, the type of targeted violence against sex workers also increases, but it also increases in the type of danger. And so much, much worse interactions on bad dates, coupled with the fact that a lot of the business is gone, which makes it much more dangerous, which means people are out on the street for many, many more hours and possibly not making anything or making very little, which increases the desperation.
And you can't say no to a client.
Exactly.
Yeah, if it's the only person in 3 hours.
Exactly. You would normally have the option to say, no, none of this feels right. But you're right, if you've been out for hours and hours and hours and there's just no business. So what we started to see was women who couldn't stop doing sex work even though they wanted to, in terms of trying to keep themselves safe. We saw women returning to sex work for the first time, or trying to return to sex work for the first time. And then a third category of folks resorting to sex work for the first time, which means you likely don't have the connections or the safest ways of doing the work and keeping yourself safe out there. So really troublesome, and it just continues to point to an increased number of barriers after barriers after barriers for this population.
Why do you think, or what are you hearing, is the reason, first of all, that there's an increase in violence against and severity of violence against sex workers? When we talked to Angela Marie from Battered Women's Services early in the pandemic, that was when they had the tripling of violence calls, and there was a lot of discussion about why this is. So let's start there.
Yeah. So it will be along that same continuum. And then what you will typically see, especially in neighborhoods like the downtown east side, where there's already quite a lot of predatory behavior towards women, period, and then certainly to those who are trading sex within a context of poverty, precarious housing, maybe food scarcity, and where sex work has to be in the mix of potential income sources. So in terms of, we will see people acting out sort of the worst of their violent or sexual predatory behavior on sex workers in neighborhoods like the downtown east side, primarily because of who the women are and what they're doing. And this ongoing belief that this kind of violence can go unreported or underreported and invisible. And they're not wrong, which is the most unfortunate piece and the most deadly piece of this type of work within a highly criminalized, highly stigmatized environment. So what we would see in terms of just societal pressures and how society takes out those pressures on women is increased on sex workers.
That's really devastating to hear.
Yeah, it's really disturbing, and it's always a fear that a tragedy has to happen before some kind of action or some kind of movement takes place. So that's always a worry, especially within the downtown East Side, where women still go missing, and where the memory of serial predation and serial murderers operating if the downtown side is not that long ago.
Tell me a bit about people who are entering the trade or returning to the trade for the first time. What are you hearing? Is that economically driven? What's the COVID connection there?
Within COVID, it is completely economically driven. So we've seen sex workers who've lost income and have not been able to replace it. And so there's a lot of new street debts. There is higher costs for a lot of the substances that are being sold throughout the downtown East Side. There are fewer housing options, fewer options to keep yourself safe, especially if people might have been couch surfing or trading sex for accommodations.
And many no guest policies now because of COVID too.
Exactly. So then layering in all of the COVID protocols has made it even more challenging to work. So guest policies, which had to be put in place in several housing, in buildings throughout the neighborhood, actually makes it difficult to work safely. And that might have been that worker's safest way to do that. So it's, as I was saying before, it's like barrier after barrier after barrier. And in that first wave, it certainly wasn't because of COVID positive results. It was all of the other impacts of spaces closing down, of going into lockdown, of business being driven away, and then no viable ways to replace that income.
What are the rules or allowances under the Connect Canada Emergency Response Benefit, or CERB? Will the government penalize sex workers who apply for it?
It's not fully clear, and so there's a lot of hesitance and reticence, and there's already a huge amount of distrust towards those systems and towards sort of putting yourself on the radar in that way. So those that are eligible have done so, and we've supported quite a number of women through their paperwork. There are others who absolutely don't want to even try, however, most of the women that we support are not eligible.
Technically, I think according to the law, Canada Revenue isn't necessarily in communication or ratting people out to the police, or in theory at least.
In theory, exactly. But it's also, given how stigmatized the trade is and how criminalized it remains, it's still worrisome. And the cost of being outed is quite varied. So there may be implications with if you're renting, there may be implications of where you're staying. If you are trying to keep your kids or get your kids back, there are implications there. You don't want that on record in any shape or form. You may lose your kids or your grandkids. So there's all of these pieces. There's a lot of people who are simply not out. And so the option of now filling in a formal government paperwork admitting that is really quite daunting.
Do you think, I know in many other areas when it comes to access to services and benefits and safety, that there's such a divide within the sex work community in terms of survival or street trade versus escort or higher end? Are you seeing that exacerbated or changed in a way because of the pandemic?
Do you mean in terms of how different groups of sex workers relate to each other, or?
I think in terms of their safety, their ability to earn income, their ability to access what they need.
Yeah, so for sure, street-based sex workers are going to be among the most vulnerable. Those that were able to move to online work or increase the amount of online work they were doing before certainly have, and many to quite a bit more success and safety. For those doing indoor work, so that's an area I know a little bit less because of our focus during COVID, but that could be a question to ask of some of the other sex work support organizations in terms of what indoor workers are facing. And then from our partners who work with immigrant and migrant sex workers, that is also a group that is really vulnerable to a mix of Canada border services mixed in with police, mixed in with an already criminalized activity. So that's a whole other group facing new levels of vulnerability as a result of COVID.
This is such an important topic in this neighborhood, and I think to many of our listeners. I know several years ago, maybe 5 years ago, the Vancouver police brought in a new policy that was guided by and advised by people in the sex work community. Have they lived up to that promise that they would not be enforcing, for instance, commercial complaints or criminal charges against sex workers for just that? Or is that something that's been followed?
Right. The Vancouver Police Department sex work enforcement guidelines.
Mm-hmm.
So it's such a tricky question to answer because you know, when we talk to the chief of police, when we talk to different superintendents or inspectors, the amount of support for the guidelines, which now, by the way, have moved to provincial guidelines. There's a new set of guidelines around sex work enforcement that are now provincial, hasn't been fully rolled out. So that's another challenge in terms of how that's actually practically rolling out throughout the province with municipalities like Vancouver versus maybe tiny towns, rural towns or smaller towns, and what does that look like there? But there's always been a bit of a disconnect between what actually happens on the ground and what some of these guidelines talk about. So I think there was an improvement in terms of recognizing sex work as work. However, there's still a lot of police on the ground that are still seeing sex work as, like, it's that immediate switch to this must be exploitation and this must be human sexual trafficking, which it certainly isn't the case, and it certainly isn't what we're seeing huge numbers of or even significant numbers of. And so we'll see a disconnect there in terms of a rescue mentality. And therefore a police presence that isn't always welcome and actually makes it harder for sex workers to work. So I would say that's been the challenge. That's been the disconnect with those guidelines. There's support for it in principle, but on the ground it doesn't always play out that way.
I guess my last question is just how are people adapting to the pandemic here in terms of positive actions to keep themselves safe and in terms of accessing your services, for instance, maybe some of the kind of the ways that people are looking out for each other or taking care of themselves to keep, keep COVID transmission down, to keep themselves safe, to check in with each other, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I think there's one of the things that I can point to is a network of service providers that have came together in the first wave and meeting quite frequently to do our own response, to do some cross-collaboration. So a lot of peer work emerged out of that. So there are lots of grassroots initiatives happening throughout the downtown east side of helping to raise the awareness of COVID and how to stay safe from it. There's still a lot of residents who maybe a little reticent and less likely to get tested or believe that this is a real threat. So there have been groups of peers who are helping to spread the word pass out flyers. Different organizations have created different peer roles to support that type of COVID prevention and information. And so those type of things have been happening. And then I would say within the women serving organizations, a lot of collaboration between ourselves and making sure that the populations that we serve are not falling through cracks. So for us, that meant really pretty much moving to 24/7 and getting the word out throughout the neighborhood that WISH is in fact 24/7 and has been for several months now. And then women just coming back to that whole outdoor space and using it as a, yes, access to services, yes, access to sanitation, but also a safe place to just hang out and be in community, which is in such short demand right now.
And of course, not using alone when possible at that space to stay alive, even while we're keeping our social distance whenever possible.
Exactly.
Well, thank you so much. That's really great to talk to you, and I hope to have you back on here anytime.
Thank you. Nice to meet you on the radio.
You too. Take care.
Bye-bye.
And that was Mebret Bayena, Executive Director of the WISH Drop-In Center Society. Find out more about their work and their new 24/7 shelter, wish-vancouver.net.
CFRO The Pulse is brought to you by the Local Journalism Initiative, a program funded by Heritage Canada and administered through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.